Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to the men and women who have served and are now serving in the United States Air Force. Okay, folks, well, here we are right now. We're back, and kind of lost the theme there. Maybe it has a little hungover from January 1. Nina? We lost it. But anyway, this is Bob Gould, your host for today. My partner, Dale Thronberry, is traveling thereabouts. And if you're listening, Dale, hello. And I'm hoping you're having a good time with your family out there in the shores of New Jersey. Veterans Radio begins another year, 2013. Wow, where's all the time gone? Been on the air over 9 years. Huh. Some people don't even stay married that long. And we've been on the air for 9 years, and we hope to stay on the air for another 9 years, God willing. Anyway, today's program is going to be about North Korea. It's a situation that I've been following as a Veterans Radio producer and host for just about 9 years. If you go to our archives at www.veteransradio.net and go back as far back as you can go, you're going to find other programs that we've completed on North Korea, including one about Father Capon, who was a POW and perished in a prison camp in North Korea. And we've had interviews with North Korean veterans. So check out those archives and other programs that we've had. Today's program will feature our guest is Dr. Rebecca Grant. She's been on our program, I believe this is her fifth opportunity, and she's always welcome. If you've all been watching the military channel, that's her. I see that every hour. I love it. It's a commercial PSA, you might say. It's 30-second spot. It shows jets taking off and various weaponry, and then there's a voiceover, and there she comes on. So, Dr. Grant, if you've all been watching the military channel, you see her. The other day, I think I counted about 20 times that spot was ran. Okay, let's get to North Korea in about 1 minute. Hey, Nina, take it away.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
That was a salute to the Air Force in honor of our guest today is Dr. Rebecca Grant. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Dr. Grant.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bob.
A little bit about Dr. Grant. Rebecca Grant is president of IRIS, Independent Research, a firm specializing in defense and aerospace research for corporate and government clients. She was trained in the field of international relations. Well, that's going to be a beautiful thing today, what we're going to find out. She holds a BA from Wellesley College, a PhD from the London School of Economics, and has worked for the RAND Corporation. Dr. Grant was a member of the Secretary of the Air Force Staff Group and the Air Force Chief of Staff's Operation Group, CCX. Since founding IRIS Independent Research in 1995, she has focused on joint doctrine, air power history, and defense strategy, all the things we're going to talk about today. Dr. Grant, once again, welcome to Veterans Radio.
I'm delighted to be here. I like the way you pronounce London School of Economics. That sounds good.
Well, I had some tea this morning. Maybe that helped a little bit.
Tea. But,
yes.
Tea, that's the thing.
I had to get out of the infirmary in order to come here today, but I've been wanting to do this program ever since, the middle of December when all this activity took place and we contacted one another. And I have very much looking forward to it. So let's get to it. The most dangerous place in the world. The most dangerous place in the world. And we don't need to get into all that. I think people, my listeners, will be able to extrapolate that from what we're going to talk about, is North Korea. And with the death of the North Korean premier, or is he a president? Do they have a premier, Dr. Grant,
I like the way the CIA Factbook describes them as a communist one-man dictatorship. So that's pretty much sums it up. And, of course, we're looking at the third generation with Kim Jong-un. He's, everyone probably remembers Kim Il-sung, who founded the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea way back when, even maybe before your time, Bob, I think. And then his son, who took over in 1994, and then now this is the third one of this family to run the country. He's been in charge just about a year, marking just about the one-year anniversary of his leadership of the DPRK.
Well, I'm fascinated by that. I was just a mere child when there was an attack on Pearl Harbor, but I've always read about that. I thought, what an interesting... In fact, I believe that is a Chinese philosophical statement. We live... I welcome you to live in interesting times. And then I've thought about that and what it must have been like as I grew older to be in that threat. And now here it is. Here it is. On December the 12th, North Korea successfully launched, regardless of how crude, a three-stage rocket, which, if it is successfully completed, will be able to go 10,000 miles. That happened on December 12th. Immediately, I emailed Dr. Grant. Dr. Grant, why don't you take it from there?
December 12th, here we are, and one of the, going back to my London roots, the UK Daily Mail Online put it really simply in their headline that day. They talked about the boy tyrant who's one step closer to nuking the West. So, sparing nothing there. There's a lot more to this story, of course, and one interesting thing is that, I think this is more of a disappointment than a surprise. There was an estimate done, something called an NIE. It's a National Intelligence Estimate. It's put together mainly by the CIA, but really by the whole intelligence community, and they'll get together and decide on a group view of a topic. And back in 1999, they formally predicted, on paper, circulated through the government, that it was very likely that North Korea would develop an intercontinental ballistic missile by the year 2015. Now, they thought this missile would not have a heavy payload. I think this estimate from some years back thought about 200 kilograms. That's not a lot. I mean, I think the people who play in the NFL who weigh a little bit more than that. But it's this capability has been out there for a long time. I think the big there was a little bit of a hope when Kim Jong-un took over that he might set a more rational course for North Korea. And I think we see this launch as a sign that just maybe is not what's going to happen here at all. He's been very belligerent in the rhetoric. This is in clear violation of everything that the UN for decades has asked North Korea to do or not to do. And so that's the thing. I think there was some real disappointment, not so much surprise, but real disappointment that he's chosen to continue down this path.
Well, the UN, right after it was launched, the UN did have a resolution banning Pyongyang from missile tests, passed after it conducted nuclear tests in 2006 and 2009. I'm sure that's continuing now, although the North Koreans are talking about that this is for peaceful purposes, and they're using it as satellite that to launch a satellite for civilian use, as probably a weather satellite or something like that. But I don't believe that. They also right, and they also have with this three-stage missile, they could reach 65,000 or 6,500 miles. There we go. Which is the west coast of the U.S. What are we doing about? There's nothing in the paper. What are we doing about that?
Well, exactly, and you know that's always the issue with satellite development. It's a little bit like how we joke about, oh, you know, the check is in the mail. Well, they say, oh, this rocket, it's for peaceful purposes, but it's the exact same technology. What's interesting about this launch was they did spot debris that looks consistent with a first and second stage fallout from the launch. This would be just basically the casing of the missile and the spent fuel portions of the rocket that went off. And then it did put an object into orbit. There's some speculation about whether this is a real functioning satellite. It's not exactly out there carrying 800 television channels or anything like that. So, but there's an object in orbit, according to the North American Air Defense Command. And you know, what are we doing about it? Well, that's sort of the problem. There's not a lot that can be done about it. It's interesting that technology has been around a long time. Bob, do you remember back to Sputnik?
Oh, there we go. I was delivering papers that night. I believe it was October of 1957. I had a night paper out, and I heard it. My dad was driving me around, and I heard it on the radio. Yes, I do remember that. Absolutely.
Boy, I hope you saved one of those papers from the next night, because that was a shock to the world that a foreign power and a communist dictatorship, which the Soviet Union was then, could put something in orbit that would go over everybody, every country and everyone. So in a way, this is a little bit like North Korea's Sputnik. It was a marker of the technology progress. But, you know, just as Sputnik didn't have a direct impact, you know, there wasn't an attack that followed up. It had a lot of secondary impacts, but there wasn't a direct impact. It didn't mean that they could, right at that moment, cause problems with it. So what this means, though, is that we have to really seriously consider the possibility that at some stage later on, North Korea might be able to take a primitive nuclear weapon and combine it with this missile. Now, there's some problems with doing that. It's not the easiest thing to accomplish, and they've had their problems even in getting this far. They had a failure in April in their launch. That's to be expected with development like this. So what we know is they've fulfilled a goal that they have, which is to be they call it self-reliant, to be it not, it turns out. I'll tell you why later on. But to be a self-reliant nuclear power. They declare themselves to be a nuclear state. And so I think there are kind of two levels of this. You can tell me which one you want to talk about first. There's the large diplomatic piece. The U.S. is very involved in that, South Korea, the whole U.N. and U.N. Security Council. And then there's the military aspects. You know, what does this mean for our forces in the Pacific?
Well, I think the military would be the place to begin, because
right,
that puts everything under the umbrella of one big threat.
It does. And so when you look at the Pacific, you know, it's interesting that this has been a pretty active year with North Korea. It's also been a watershed year here in Washington in terms of the military policy. I think we talked about this before, Bob, but just a year ago, in fact, exactly a year ago today, on January 5th, 2012, the White House came out with a new defense strategy. And it basically said, we are going to start to take much more interest in the Asia-Pacific region. And it named names in a few places, but the overall thrust of it was just like what you said. North Korea is a dangerous place. China is on the rise. So let's reposture our forces as we come out of Afghanistan and Iraq and make sure that we have what we need in the Pacific. Part of that, of course, is to reassure our many allies there that U.S. military forces will be with them and will be capable of contending with threats just like this one.
Now, just like Israel, they go out, and when they've had enough, they take it out. I know right now it's at the rough stage, but is there anything that's ever been planned on looking at to take out the facility that is creating this in the future?
Well, there are a whole lot of pieces to this, and let me back it up for a minute first, Bob, if you don't mind, and talk a little bit about what you have to have for military forces once you're in a theater with this type of threat. And the first thing that's so critical is a really good way to watch what's going on in North Korea and to be able to detect a missile launch very quickly. And that requires a pretty complex series of linking together. The first time that you'll see a missile will be most likely from an overhead satellite that has a really, really top-notch infrared detector on it. We have a constellation of those up, and they can see literally the flames and the plume from that big missile launch. So that'll give you an immediate hot hit that there's a missile there. But the next thing that's necessary, and here's something that the administration is really concentrated on, is to get some good radar in place to be able to track the direction of that missile. And you want to know, is it going right or left? Is it heading south down towards Australia? Is it heading to Japan? Is it coming for Alaska, Hawaii, Los Angeles? So it's key to get that trajectory in place. And here it's interesting. Secretary of Defense Panetta talked recently in pretty vague terms, but the message was that we are putting some bigger, better radars in place in the Pacific. He didn't specify where. I think we can all, make a guess as to where that might be. But to get some really good ground-based radar there to help assess if there's a pip that comes up out of North Korea, a hot pip, then what is that missile doing? Where is it going? Does the trajectory suggest that it's intercontinental or just short range and heading off like that? So those are the kind of things that you have to do first to see what the threat is like in that theater.
Well, it's certainly there now, and it's got everybody's attention. And here I'm actually living that. I feel threatened, but boy, that certainly wasn't good news. I think about our stock market, our economy, our well-being, and of our neighbors and our allies. You mentioned Australia and the United States and other countries that are within that 6,500-mile range. And even if it is crude, and they manage to and they do manage to get a nuclear, that's what I'm thinking right away, nuclear up in the air, and it is successful, they go through the atmosphere, which I understand is one big major developmental hurdle that they're going to have to get through. It's no longer interesting times. It's dangerous, and boy, I want to bring that on to our listeners here at Veterans Radio. I want them to know through you, Dr. Grant, and you know all this information, to pass that along so that maybe we could take a deep breath.
Exactly. And here's what I think it means. I talked earlier about how, in a way, it's a disappointment that we're not going to have in this new young leader someone who wants to act sensibly, you know, I think there was some hope for that. What this missile launch says to me is, you know, worst case is now we're in for another decade or so of watching North Korea closely, wondering what the heck they're up to and how are they coming in potentially mating a missile with a nuclear warhead. But I think let's talk a little bit about what this does for them, what this gets them. And I think it gives them an enormous bargaining chip. I think there's probably less of a likelihood that they're going to immediately put this thing up and send it over friendly territory and let it go. You have to sort of think through what would be the reason for that. This is a knife they're going to want to hold to our throats more than actually make the attack. So what have we done to prepare? Well, as you may know, the last 10 years or so have been some pretty interesting times in terms of missile defenses. I'm sure you remember back to the 1980s and the Star Wars and the Strategic Defense Initiative, which talked about putting a missile shield in place.
Yes,
you remember?
Yes, I do.
Well, you didn't still have a paper route back then, did you?
No, I didn't. But I was reading the papers, and that was sort of stopped in its tracks, right? I was about in the initial stages. Now, what does that mean, if we could just digress to that, if we would have had something like that in place?
Well, the thing is, we actually we do have parts of it in place. So the big initiative that President Reagan announced in 1983, I think it was, did not pan out. But what it did was it really stimulated development of a few theater-based systems. And one of the most obvious results of this is we do have a small set of missile interceptors deployed up in Alaska. And these programs really started to work out in about the last 10 years. We've been very focused on Afghanistan and Iraq and our service members engaged there, but quietly, there was a lot of progress being made in the ground-based intercept system, also in the Navy's ability to do sea-based missile defense, using intercept missiles fired off of cruisers, for example, out in the Pacific. Japan, our staunch ally, also has this ability, and they, the Japanese Navy, Japan Self-Defense Force Navy, and our U.S. Navy take turns on the picket out in the Western Pacific watching for potential missile launches
intercept. Can I just say something right here? I think maybe some of our audience doesn't know what a picket is, a picket line. Perhaps you could just take a second or two and explain that?
A picket line. We have to go back about to the Civil War.
I know. I'm just reading Lincoln, so that came to my mind. But a picket.
A picket. Well, back in Lincoln's time, the Confederates and then the Union would put a few soldiers out on the front in advance of the camp or the line, and that would basically be the picket line to see if the enemy was coming over, and if anyone started to come over, this picket line would be the first into the skirmish. That's how I read it. What do you think, Bob?
It sounds like the same thing on the sea.
Exactly. And so the idea of a picket line at sea goes back to, well, certainly back to World War II. My dad served in the Pacific in World War II, and you would have destroyers out on the picket line there watching for the, you know, the bad guys to come over the horizon. So when I talk about a picket line, it's sort of an old-fashioned term, but what it means in this case is that the United States Navy and the Japan Self-Defense Force Navy have some of their really very best cruisers with super, super Aegis radar, which is a detection radar, and the intercept missiles like the Standard Missile 3 that they carry aboard. And they are there 24/7 providing both a component of the radar coverage to determine where the missile track is going, and also providing the ability to engage that missile. Now, all of this, and including the ground-based interceptors I talked about earlier, all this comes back into the command centers of United States Pacific Command. And can you guess where those are, Bob?
Colorado.
No, in this case, it's Pearl Harbor. So now you're right that Colorado and NORAD does have the ability to watch this as well, but a lot of the command and control for the Pacific comes into what they call PACOM for Pacific Command. And the commander there at the moment is a Navy Admiral, as is always traditionally the case. It's Navy Admiral Samuel Locklear, came in from the Pacific just several months ago to take up the PACOM job, which is a real plum. And he was one of the ones who talked about really hoping, you know, in fact, he spoke just a few days before the launch and said that he was really hoping that North Korea would try to go down a more rational course. But that, in fact, since they are this self-proclaimed nuclear state, that their actions are very, very destabilizing. And, you know, it's interesting because he's one of the senior military leaders who has to deal with this. He probably gets a North Korea briefing every morning, more or less, and has to find out what they're up to and think about what the forces in his theater might be subject to.
You know, as I listen to you and disseminate this information and put it into a cohesive structure, it's almost boggling because we don't know this. Or should we know this as a population or just get little bits and pieces? Maybe I'm getting too political on that, but I didn't know any of this. And I'm not sure even if that relaxes my mind to the threat that I may be living in a nuclear time.
Well, exactly. I think as a nation, we have understandably been very focused on the aftermath of 9/11 and on our forces in Afghanistan and, of course, in Iraq. So it's easy for us, I think, as Americans to focus just on one thing and forget some of the other pieces. That's why the strategy shift, which has been, it was done by the Obama administration, but I think has been applauded by the Republican Party as well as being, you know, high time to focus more on the Pacific, and this is one of the reasons. You know, Korea was a big issue in the 1990s as they started to go down this road of further missile development, and it's a very intricate, you know, the way that they've done this. Again, Secretary of Defense Panetta, when asked about who was helping the North Koreans build this missile, because, you know, this is a closed economy, right? And so he said, well, they are getting some help from China. And he's very close-mouthed about it. What's quite interesting, he said he didn't know how much, which I find intriguing because he said this when he was Secretary of Defense. But as we remember, Leon Panetta was director of the CIA for a few years prior to that. So I suspect he knows much more about the nature of China's assistance to North Korea than he's at liberty to talk about. But China is not the only tie. So this will really scare you a little bit, I think, because it does me. North Korea has ties with Iran. They have ties with Pakistan, particularly, this is a little bit older, but they were censured by the UN for allegedly providing nuclear know-how to the Khan outfit in Pakistan in the 90s. I think up until quite recently, one of their very few allies has been Syria. So that's a great set of friends to
yeah,
have.
Yeah.
You know, and clearly China's the big player here, but we'll...
And their surrogate to do the saber rattling is North Korea.
Well, I think you know, it is just hard to make any sense of what they want here. You know, most of North Korea's military, or quite a bit of it, And they have a huge military. We have to talk about that a little bit, because that's really where push comes to shove, is right there on the peninsula.
We're coming to a station break, Dr. Grant, and I know we've really kept you on the air here quite a while, and you just might want to get yourself a quick cup of coffee. We're going to take a PSA, then we're going to come right back to that. And North Korea and Dr. Rebecca Grant right here on Veterans Radio WDEO.
You're listening to Veterans Radio from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, and online at avemaria.net.
On the way to your college degree, you've hit some roadblocks. You decide it's time to change direction. The Air Force can help. We offer educational assistance, high-tech job training, and experience. The credits you've earned may help you start your Air Force career at a higher rank, and will pay off your student loans up to $10,000 if you qualify. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio, and with us as our guest today is Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS Independent Research, a firm specializing in defense and aerospace research for corporate and government clients. And we've kept her on a long, long time, folks, and I know that you appreciate that, because this is a real, real serious issue. And Dr. Grant, I do want to read this before we really get into who's backing this. Is BBC Asia analyst Charles Scanlon says the North clearly wants its threat to be taken seriously, believing this to be the best way of deterring potential aggression, boosting the prestige of the leader, and being granted equal diplomatic status. Well, what do you think about that, Dr. Grant?
Pretty interesting list. Deterring aggression and granting or achieving diplomatic status. And here's what's so unfortunate about North Korea. They've done exactly the wrong thing to achieve any of those goals. The interesting part, and I agree, of course, with the analyst, he's spot on, but wow, to think they need to do this missile to deter aggression is just crazy. The North Korean Army has 1.1 million soldiers on active status, another 4.7 million reserves, and this is a country whose population is under 30 million, I believe. It's not a large country at all, and as we know, very cut off, very isolated. I think they have about a million telephones. They only just got cell phone service in the capital last year, and as is well known, and hopefully we can talk about this maybe towards the end, they're really not online either. They have just very few internet providers, and they're really cut off. So this relatively small country, but a huge military, and if the size of the armed forces aren't daunting enough, let me tell you a little bit about what kind of equipment they have. This is an outfit that's got about 3,000 tanks, possibly 10,000 surface-to-air missiles, possibly another 11,000 air defense guns. They've got about 600 combat aircraft. And here's the best part. They have a tunnel system. They're really famous for having this tunnel that supposedly goes under the demilitarized zone. So it's a DMZ, you know, it's about 4 kilometers across, runs 250 kilometers long. Our analysts believe that there are 20 tunnels underneath which the North Korean Army could use to invade the South and to shelter from air attack, to drive through artillery pieces and tanks. And of this, the reports say that of the 20 tunnels, we only know where 4 of them are.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this is not a country you're going to go out and attack. Yeah. So the notion that they want to deter aggression is just a little silly. You know, the whole strategy on the Korean Peninsula, really, for the better part of the last 60 years, has been to deter attack by the North. And it's thought that if the North were to attack, that they would lose. But the trouble is, everything is so close. Seoul is about, you know, 25 or 30 miles south of the DMZ. Even Pyongyang is pretty close. I think it's 60 to 80 miles north. So you're talking about a really small area. You know, I live out here towards Annapolis, Maryland, and I think the distance from my house to the capital, the U.S. capital, is probably about the same as from Seoul to the DMZ. So it's really close. So they already have this formidable military force. And to put an intercontinental missile capability on top of it is really just, that's just really rub salt, you know. And it's the last thing that's going to get them any kind of international recognition that they claim to want.
Well, Charles Scandian actually says one other. He said the North has been happy to declare itself a nuclear power, and frequently it by threatening its neighboring countries in the U.S. with massive retaliation for perceived slights. It's the little guy carrying a big stick, and look at me, and I can shout. And back when the sticks were not as huge and powerful, so you had to have many outside forces working to conduct that. But now, with what we have in the missile technology and what has, by the way, folks, that whole rocket. Where do I have that here? They strapped together four missiles that they had had before. I'm trying to think of that. Oh, yeah, there we go. The Rodong missile engines. They strapped four of these right around, must be some sort of body, and they were latched together. And then the second stage was a Scud-type missile engine. That was their second stage booster. That's all it took, folks. And now, wow, that means... Oh, I think there was a Peter Sellers movie about that, The Mouse That Roared. Well, all of a sudden, that little mouse is roaring big time, and it's using crude technology, crude equipment, and they have us, this huge power, standing by, standing on alert. I'm not sure if they've successfully achieved their goals, what they have currently, or is this just a result, and anybody or any small nation can go out there and get this crude technology and put all this together. Dr. Grant, am I thinking correctly on this? Is this just a faux pas to get us all excited and then calm down and get us excited again to have this prestige in the world? Is that true?
No, I think you're right that they really are the mouse that roared. And the problem is that whereas for the last many decades the idea was to contain North Korea, that's sort of the last example of that mid-20th century policy of containment. And with this missile launch, they've broken out of that barrier a bit. And the trouble is that, I mean, just the launch itself. You talked about the stages put together and built around then the Scud motor. It is pretty crude, I must say. There are some other nations that have tried to do similar things. Iraq messed around with this kind of stuff, too. But look where it fell. I mean, the debris went, you know, by the Philippines and near Okinawa, and just a complete disregard for the sovereignty of these other nations. And what's to say they won't try to do that again? I mean, that's just not the way that we want a nation to behave in the 21st century, not one that wants to be part of the family of nations.
Now, folks, in analyzing some of that debris that they found in the ocean and that they've been able to recover, the welding was so crude, it was handheld. It had we used to call it bird droppings when I worked in the factories way back then. You can imagine it's very descriptive. And so they're just putting this together, folks, and they're putting it up in the air, and then they can pound their chests and rattle their sabers. And I love the way you said that they're just they're landing wherever they can land, kill somebody. Well, that's the way it goes. And I guess I still maintain that with that kind of mentality, and who directly is pulling the strings? Is that Iran?
Pulling the strings. That's the funny thing about North Korea. I think you have to look to the leader, you know, Kim Jong-un. He's the one who's quote-unquote pulling the strings. Why are other nations involved with them? I think there's a quid pro quo with countries like Iran, that there's some real valid exchanges of technology, materiel of some sort. I think that's the case with Iran and with Pakistan some years ago. And I think to an extent, it didn't bother Iran or possibly China to see North Korea provoke and embarrass and bother the United States and our allies. That was sort of a nice payback, you know. That's fine. Let them go ahead and stir the pot a little bit. But I think this is really different. And in fact, even China has said that they kind of regret this violation. And I don't know if you want to take that too seriously, but
well,
clearly
I
they're
like
not encouraging
that.
It.
I definitely like hearing that. Whether yes, it does. It does somewhat relax me when I think about that in this time that I'm living in. And I would rather have that than nothing being said at all, whether it's truthful or not. It's still it went out there to the world, and people are hearing that. And now, through you, we're hearing that. And again, the papers are just, they've buried this thing. I look day after day. What? Come on, give me more. Give me it. Unless you go on the internet, it's buried. Wow. Go ahead.
That's true. It's like you say, it's been a little more prominent in the regional press in Asia. And with we've had some great commentators here. I think of Misha Oslin, who is a scholar, a PhD here at the American Enterprise Institute, and writes an Asia column in the Wall Street Journal. Misha has written about North Korea, and there's several adroit Korea hands here in Washington who follow it. It's a long, tortured history. But I think what it changes now, you know, the real tragedy for some time has been that North Korea is very poor. You know, they've had to receive food aid. They had some devastating floods in 2007. So here you really do have just the most terrible dictator who appears to not care a thing about his population. One of the scenarios that U.S. forces in Korea have long kind of planned for is, what if North Korea simply collapses? And it creates an immense humanitarian crisis within the country, so that the international community has to respond with aid, food and direct aid into North Korea, and has to try to stabilize a country with that much military equipment. I mean, that's one of almost the worst scenarios. You know, I think what we'd all like to see is better integration between the North and South. There have been times when there was more hope for that. Of course, South Korea is about, I think, to have a new leader themselves. They've been very prosperous. The South Korean military has taken over quite a bit more command responsibility with the ground forces, particularly on the Korean Peninsula. That's a very wealthy, sophisticated, modern state, and of course with still a lot of family ties to the North. You know, we'd like to see them all get back together. But where's the incentive? You know, when you look about China, the other, you know, rising power in the region, we have a lot of questions about China and their military and where they're going. But China is part of the global economy, part of the global family of nations. There are things they want, and it's a nation with whom one can have a much more normal set of relations. North Korea is just the anomaly.
Well, we're coming up on our third break, and that's a very appropriate time now to take a quick stop. So our wrap-up will have about 12 minutes. And you can, again, you've been absolutely fantastic. I can see your voice is kind of slipping, too. So I hope you have some tea in front of you and take a sip. And we'll be right back right after this very important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
The Air Force is the only branch of service with its own community college. It's called the Community College of the Air Force, and it makes a difference. You see, in the Air Force, you earn college credit for learning your job. You can earn an associate's degree in one of 66 career fields. Your job experience goes farther in the Air Force. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio, and with me, our guest today is Dr. Rebecca Grant, from President of IRIS, a research organization that does policy study for the Air Force. Dr. Grant is a spokesperson for the Air Force, and we're so pleased to have you on. I mean, we are really breaking ground here, folks. There's the things that you just don't know about, and I'm finding out for the first time. But here's my question. We have about 12 minutes. So the UN had resolutions that banned North Korea from launching this basic missile technology, economic sanctions aimed at really blocking North Korea from acquiring nuclear and missile technology. But it didn't work. Are we back to that now? We're back in the late 40s, early 50s. Is that what's the UN going to do? What are they going to do? And it's just a toothless tiger. Is that what happened here?
Well, it's a good question about the UN, and especially it's what you said. It didn't work, and that's been the problem all along. There have been lots of sets of sanctions and carrot and stick approaches, and certainly the UN, well, it's the UN that's been in charge of that security situation since the war ended in 1953. The real key with the UN and North Korea is, of course, China. As a permanent member of the Security Council, China has a lot of influence not only in whether the resolutions pass, which they generally do, but how strong they are. And I think this launch really raises a question for China. China also has a new leader and have said they want to be part of a peaceful rise. So here's the question, China. Can you step up and try to deal a little more strongly with this state, to which China has given support over the years? North Korea, because it is it looks like from the outside, a heartless dictatorship, they're really a tough nut for the international community. One can impose sanctions, and in fact, the U.S. Stopped its food aid earlier in 2012 when they announced that they would do the missile launch. They tried in April.
So what's the point of that, though? We're starving the population so that they'll revolt? Is that what we're looking at?
That's exactly the thing. That, you know, can you put sanctions on, you don't want to hurt the population. Of course, the sanctions are aimed to influence the government. But in the words of the CIA, North Korea is a one-man communist dictatorship. So what will influence the mind of Kim Jong-un? He has made clear that he's really in charge. He's fired some military leaders, put some others back in charge. It's believed he's put really hardline leaders in the top of the North Korean military. So I think the international community looks at this and says, wow, we could try to starve him out for decades, and we might get down to just that ruling group left. You know, the international community does not want to create a humanitarian disaster here. So that's a very, very delicate line to walk. What behavior will change the stance of this dictatorship in North Korea? And what will allow the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors to get back into that country and try to determine what's going on? You know, what are the next rational steps? And we're going to have to look to China to try to help us a little more aggressively with this.
I'm sitting here just thinking about what that move was to with the whole, was it, it wasn't total food aid, but food aid in general, and that to me is a drastic step. That to me shows me we're at DEFCON 3 or 4, and we're not right here in the beginning to have that. I mean, to put that population, the leader himself is not without food and et cetera, or either is the army, but there is the population. So I see that as a real drastic measure by the U.S. to get this thing off dead center. And but what do you think about that? And is it not drastic to do that, to withhold food aid?
It was a very serious step indeed, and one I'm sure our government hated to take. But when the North Koreans came out in, I think, February of 2012 and said, we are going to demonstrate an intercontinental ballistic missile, how could the U.S. continue to provide aid? It was the last little thing to do to try to stop them from the failed April test and then the successful December test. So we don't have a lot more that we can do, and I think that's why there's been such aggravation over the last couple days about the imminent visit by the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, along with Bill Richardson, former New Mexico governor and former ambassador to the UN, who are planning to go to North Korea as private citizens on a business trip. And they it's funny, they said, well, they'd actually planned to go in the fall, and they put it off because of this launch. Now they want to reschedule the trip. But the idea is, oh, you know, we just don't seem to have any leverage with them. We need to find leverage between the United States, with the help of China, find some leverage that will get them off this terrible track of developing this dangerous technology while their own people are going without the basic necessities.
That is so well put. And how you put that together, and I'm thinking about this. I mean, my mind is racing right now. I'm putting all this together in my mind. And what do they have as an economy? They don't make a car. I don't think they make any. I'm talking about the North Koreans now, and they certainly don't make any television. So the military is it, and the rest is agro, correct?
That's right, and it's really subsistence stuff. They do have their own electricity generation, but they're really very, very underdeveloped, very backwards in terms of their economy and the length. And it wouldn't take long, I think, if there was more opening to them. They're sort of like Cuba without any of the inherent prosperity that Cuba had for a long time. They're very, very dependent. But I think the other thing that remains a problem with the missile launch is this means that now we're not in a position to back down on our military forces. You asked earlier, you know, do we have some ability to take out a potential missile launch site, especially maybe a few years down the road if we're worried about a nuclear device on that missile. And the thing is, we will have to keep our ground and naval and especially our air forces primed to deal with anything that might erupt there. And that means we'll have to try to have the ability, if it comes to it as a last resort, to go in there and attempt a strike. I mean, again, this is the last thing we want to see, but it's not something we can ignore. So we'll need to continue to keep our aircraft stationed there, both land-based and sea-based. And that's going to be one of the missions for our long-range bomber force, is to be able, if asked, to present some options with regard to North Korea.
I'm not sure how to respond to the fact now that even after this threat has been established, that we're sending delegates over there, perhaps for them, we're talking to North Koreans now, to manufacture goods that are going to be sold here. I'm shaking my head. This just doesn't happen. But I suppose in today's, the way the technology is, the military technology, that politically we have to, in a way, rescue these people. I know there's folks, what are we going to do that for? Let them all die. Well, you just can't do that either, folks. And we, Dr. Grant just very, very, very effectively described all that. And I'm going to have a lot to think about today, and I'm going to talk this over with friends of mine. I want to get the dialogue started again. We have about 3 minutes, Dr. Grant. Is there something that you'd like to cover in a very short span? Perhaps pull it all together.
We'll pull it all together. Well, here's what we all hope for North Korea, and that is that the North Korean people decide they want something better for themselves. I'm not talking about a revolt, but I think that's, you know, sort of the upside of the potential visit by the Google team to North Korea. We'd love to have them have some internet access and think about maybe some different ways to be part of the international community. So, you know, we're all hoping that with the good offices of China, with South Korea there, hopefully ready to be open arms when the time comes, that there will be some softening either by the dear leader himself, by Kim Jong-un, or somehow through the North Korean people, that country will decide that they and that their children deserve better than what they have, and because that will then take away this almost insoluble security problem as well.
Well, our own saber rattling, our own it has not achieved the goal, and these the weapon technology that is available make it available to any small size country to do this. And I mean, we could go in there and take care of everything. But that was the old way. That was the way that the thinking back in the Cold War. And I know we don't want to go back to that again. And I like this humanitarian approach. I very much, very much like this. Dr. Grant, we've kept you on a long time. And I know that you probably have a busy schedule today. Are you going to go out and ride your bike?
I might. It's a beautiful, frosty, but beautiful day here on the East Coast.
Folks, very quickly, when I was pre-interviewing Dr. Grant a while back when she first was coming on one of her first visits on the program, I asked her off the air what her recreation was. She says, oh, I ride my bike. I said, I got a Schwinn. She said, no, what did you tell me? You have a 250? What?
How? Oh, Bob, I have a Kawasaki 450.
450?
It's a street bike.
Street legal, folks. Can you imagine seeing this? Anyway, God bless you. Thank you very much for giving your time and your family for letting you spend this time with us. God bless you, and please come back again.
Thank you, Bob. Really enjoyed it.
Well, that's it, folks. Wow. And we're down to the final 20 seconds. Nina, what do we have? Oh, I think we have Colonel Christine Cook. Dale will be back next week, and he'll be hosting Colonel Cook. And not sure exactly what's going to be the topic. When we're down to 9, 8, oh boy, I can do the countdown. So this is Bob Gould and Dale Thronberry and Nina D.A. saying, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.